telling your parents, your relatives, and your friends everything you do. On the other hand, if you have no personal history, no explanations are needed. Nobody is angry or disillusioned with your acts, and above all, no one pins you down with their thoughts. Suddenly, the idea became clear in my mind. I'd almost known it myself, but I'd never examined it. Not having personal history was indeed an appealing concept, at least on the intellectual level. It gave me, however, a sense of loneliness, which I found threatening and distasteful. I wanted to discuss my feelings with him, but I kept myself in check. Something was terribly incongruous in the situation at hand. I felt ridiculous trying to get into a philosophical argument with an old Indian who obviously didn't have the sophistication of a university student. Somehow, he had led me away from my original intention of asking him about his genealogy. I don't know how we ended up talking about this, when all I wanted was some names for my charts, I said, trying to steer the conversation back to the topic I wanted. It's terribly simple, he said. The way we ended up talking about it was because I said that to ask questions about one's past is a bunch of crap. His tone was firm. I felt there was no way to make him budge, so I changed my tactics. Is this idea of not having personal history something that the Yaquis do? I asked. It's something that I do. Where did you learn it? I learned it during the course of my life. Did your father teach you that? No. Let's say that I learned it by myself, and now I'm going to give you its secret, so you won't go away empty-handed today. He lowered his voice to a dramatic whisper. I laughed at his histrionics. I had to admit that he was stupendous at that. The thought crossed my mind that I was in the presence of a born actor. Write it down, he said patronizingly. Why not? You seem to be more comfortable writing. I looked at him, and my eyes must have betrayed my confusion. He slapped his thighs and laughed with great delight. It's best to erase all personal history, he said slowly, as if giving me time to write it down in my clumsy way, because that would make us free from the encumbering thoughts of other people. I couldn't believe that he was actually saying that. I had a very confusing moment. He must have read in my face my inner turmoil and used it immediately. Take yourself, for instance, he went on saying. Right now, you don't know whether you're coming or going. And that is so because I have erased my personal history. I have little by little created a fog around me and my life. And now, nobody knows for sure who I am or what I do. You yourself know who you are, don't you? I interjected. You bet I don't, he exclaimed, and rolled on the floor, laughing at my surprised look. He'd paused long enough to make me believe that he was going to say that he did know, as I was anticipating it. His subterfuge was very threatening to me. I actually became afraid. That is the little secret I'm going to give you today, he said in a low voice. Nobody knows my personal history. Nobody knows who I am or what I do. Not even I. He squinted his eyes. He wasn't looking at me, but beyond me, over my right shoulder. He was sitting cross-legged, his back was straight, and yet he seemed to be so relaxed. At that moment, he was the very picture of fierceness. I fancied him to be an Indian chief, a red-skinned warrior in the romantic frontier sagas of my childhood. My romanticism carried me away, and the most insidious feeling of ambivalence enveloped me. I could sincerely say that I liked him a great deal, and in the same breath, I could say that I was deadly afraid of him. He maintained that strange stare for a long moment. How can I know who I am when I am all this? He said, sweeping the surroundings with a gesture of his head. Then he glanced at me and smiled. Little by little, you must create a fog around yourself. You must erase everything around you until nothing can be taken for granted, until nothing is any longer for sure or real. Your problem now is that you're too real. Your endeavors are too real. Your moods are too real. Don't take things so for granted. You must begin to erase yourself. What for? I asked belligerently. It became clear to me then that he was prescribing behavior for me. All my life, I'd reached a breaking point when someone attempted to tell me what to do. The mere thought of being told what to do put me immediately on the defensive. You said that you wanted to learn about plants, he said calmly. Do you want to get something for nothing? What do you think this is? We agreed that you would ask me questions and I'd tell you what I know. If you don't like it, there's nothing else we can say to each other. His terrible directness made me feel peeved, and begrudgingly, I conceded that he was right. Let's put it this way, then, he went on. If you want to learn about plants, since there's really nothing to say about them, you must, among other things, erase your personal history. How? I asked. Begin with simple things, such as not revealing what you really do. Then you must leave everyone who knows you well. This way, you'll build up a fog around yourself. But that's absurd, I protested. Why shouldn't people know me? What's wrong with that? What's wrong is that once they know you, you're an affair take it for granted, and from that moment on, you won't be able to break the tie of their thoughts. I personally like the ultimate freedom of being unknown. No one knows me with steadfast certainty, the way people know you, for instance. But that would be lying. I'm not concerned with lies or truths, he said severely. Lies are lies only if you have personal history. I argued that I didn't like to deliberately mystify people or mislead them. His reply was that I misled everybody anyway. The old man had touched a sore spot in my life. I didn't pause to ask him what he meant by that or how he knew that I mystified people all the time. I simply reacted to his statement, defending myself by means of an explanation. I said that I was painfully aware that my family and friends believed I was unreliable, when in reality I'd never told a lie in my life. You always knew how to lie, he said. The only thing that was missing was that you didn't know why to do it. Now you do. I protested. Don't you see that I'm really sick and tired of people thinking that I'm unreliable? I said. But you are unreliable, he replied with conviction. Damn it to hell, man, I am not, I exclaimed. My mood, instead of forcing him into seriousness, made him laugh hysterically. I really despised the old man for all his cockiness. Unfortunately, he was right about me. After a while, I calmed down, and he continued talking. When one doesn't have personal history, he explained, nothing that one says can be taken for a lie. Your trouble is that you have to explain everything to everybody, compulsively. And at the same time, you want to keep the freshness, the newness of what you do. Well, since you can't be excited after explaining everything you've done, you lie in order to keep on going. I was truly bewildered by the scope of our conversation. I wrote down all the details of our exchange in the best way I could, concentrating on what he was saying, rather than pausing to deliberate on my prejudices or on his meanings. "From now on," he said, "you must simply show people whatever you care to show them, but without ever telling exactly how you've done it." "I can't keep secrets," I exclaimed. "What you're saying is useless to me." "Then change," he said cuttingly, and with a fierce glint in his eyes. He looked like a strange, wild animal, and yet he was so coherent in his thoughts and so verbal. My annoyance gave way to a state of irritating confusion. "You see," he went on, "we only have two alternatives. We either take everything for sure and real, or we don't. If we follow the first, we end up bored to death with ourselves and with the world. If we follow the second, and erase personal history, we create a fog around us, a very exciting and mysterious state in which nobody knows where the rabbit will pop out. Not even ourselves." I contended that erasing personal history would only increase our sensation of insecurity. "When nothing is for sure, we remain alert, perennially on our toes," he said. "It's more exciting not to know which bush the rabbit is hiding behind than to behave as though we know everything." He didn't say another word for a very long time. Perhaps an hour went by in complete silence. I didn't know what to ask. Finally, he got up and asked me to drive him to the nearby town. I didn't know why, but our conversation had drained me. I felt like going to sleep. He asked me to stop on the way and told me that if I wanted to relax, I had to climb to the flat top of a small hill on the side of the road and lie down on my stomach with my head towards the east. He seemed to have a feeling of urgency. I didn't want to argue, or perhaps I was too tired to even speak. I climbed the hill and did as he had prescribed. I slept only 2 or 3 minutes, but it was sufficient to have my energy renewed. We drove to the center of town, where he told me to let him off. "Come back," he said, as he stepped out of the car. "Be sure to come back." 3. Losing self-importance. I had the opportunity of discussing my 2 previous visits to Don Juan with the friend who had put us in contact. It was his opinion that I was wasting my time. I related to him in every detail the scope of our conversation. He thought I was exaggerating and romanticizing, a silly old fogey. There was very little room in me for romanticizing such a preposterous old man. I sincerely felt that his criticism about my personality had seriously undermined my liking him. Yet I had to admit that they had always been apropos, sharply delineated, and true to the letter. The crux of my dilemma at that point was my unwillingness to accept that Don Juan was very capable of disrupting all my preconceptions about the world, and my unwillingness to agree with my friend, who believed that the old Indian was just nuts. I felt compelled to pay him another visit before I made up my mind. Wednesday, December 28th, 1960. Immediately after I arrived at his house, he took me for a walk in the desert chaparral. He didn't even look at the bag of groceries that I brought him. He seemed to have been waiting for me. We walked for hours. He didn't collect or show me any plants. He did, however, teach me an appropriate form of walking. He said that I had to curl my fingers gently as I walked, so I would keep my attention on the trail and the surroundings. He claimed that my ordinary way of walking was debilitating, and that one should never carry anything in the hands. If things had to be carried, one should use a knapsack or any sort of carrying net or shoulder bag. His idea was that by forcing the hands into a specific position, one was capable of greater stamina and greater awareness.